Do you ever wonder, what are people saying about me? What do they think of me? Do you ever wish you could get the answers to those kinds of questions? Wouldn't you like to know what people say about you? I suspect that at some level, all of us would like to know, what are people saying about us? But at another level, maybe we'd rather not know. Do I really want to know what people are saying behind my back? Do I really want to know what they think of me? Jesus wants to know. He doesn't ask, what are people saying about me? But he asks this question, who do people say that the Son of Man is? It's a different question, but in the context of what he's been doing, it's not all that different from what are people saying about me? What are you hearing? It's not all that different because what people are saying about him, their opinion of him, and who they are saying he is, their understanding of his identity, are both questions related to his actions and his impact. Because by this point in Matthew's gospel, Jesus has been busy and he's been making quite an impression. He's been healing, casting out demons, feeding thousands, and doing other kinds of miracle working. He's been teaching in parables, challenging the religious authorities, gathering followers. He's called himself a prophet. He's in some ways picked up the mantle of John the Baptist, but in other ways, he's taken the work further. He's done enough to establish a track record of sorts. So among the questions at hand are these questions. How is it all being interpreted? What do people think? What are they saying? Anytime someone comes to the attention of the crowds, the general public, there are going to be opinions about what the person's motives are, about whether what they're doing is good or bad, about whether we like them or not, about how exactly they are being consistent or inconsistent in terms of actions and intentions. Jesus wants to know, who do people say that I am? And along with that, I think he must be wondering about other related questions as well. What do they think of me? How are they understanding my ministry? Are they for me or against me? What do they believe about me? How are they interpreting my actions, my presence? Who do they think that I am? Back in Jesus' time, there was no polling service. There's no way to survey the crowds. No exit poll data from the crowd of thousands after they left that loaves and fishes thing, for example. There were no statistics, only word of mouth. So what did Jesus do when he wanted to know? He went with word of mouth. He asked his trusted sources, his disciples. And when he asked, they gave him some answers. Some think you are one of the prophets of old, come back to life, they told him, or John the Baptist all over again. Now, I might remind you that just a few chapters earlier in John chapter 14, it is reported that Herod himself thought that maybe Jesus was John the Baptist raised from the dead. So according to the disciples, some people think something strange, something supernatural must be going on with Jesus. Could it be that maybe he's a resurrected being and earlier authority come back to life? It would explain the miracles. It might even explain why he challenges the religious leaders with such confidence and authority. Maybe he's Elijah or Jeremiah returned. What's interesting in what the disciples tell Jesus about what they are hearing is that all of those answers, some say you are Elijah or Jeremiah or John the Baptist, all of those answers are backwards looking, as if Jesus has come to the present moment through a time travel almost. Jesus takes it in. He listens to their answers, their reports, and then he turns the question a little bit from who do they say that I am to who do you say I am? And when the question shifts from the general opinions of the people to the personal perspectives of the disciples, Simon Peter steps up, as he often does in these chapters in Matthew's gospel, only at this point he's not yet Simon Peter, he's Simon, son of Jonah. Anyway, he answers Jesus, and his answer is kind of startling, not just because it's different from what the disciples reported they had been hearing from the people, but because his is the first answer that doesn't focus on the past, doesn't look backwards. but rather points forward. He's the first one who doesn't say, "You are a prophet of old." Instead, he says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." It's quite a shift away from repeat or recycle to new news. You are the Messiah. Not, "You are someone who reminds us of someone we used to know," or "You're someone we've read about in the history books," but rather, "You are someone we have been waiting for. You are someone we've been promised." And then Jesus, in turn, names Simon with a new name, a forward-looking name. He calls him Peter, the Rock. It's a new name, not one from the past, not even one from the Jewish tradition. Nowhere in the history of the great prophets, priests, or kings of Israel has the name Peter ever shown up before. No, this is a new name. This is not a name of the past. This is a name of the future, of the church to come. "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." I just think this is so interesting. All around them in the conversations, in the discussions, in the gossip, through all the sources of information available to the disciples, the identities suggested, the interpretations of who this Jesus might be, are backward-looking, rooted in the past, built upon the heroes of the past, the names of the past, even the heritage of the past. But then in this short little exchange, Jesus and Peter shifted into forward, out of reverse, out of neutral, into forward. "You are the Messiah. You are the one we've been waiting for. And you are Peter," now named not for a heritage, a memory, or even a particular family, but named for a predicted and promised future. These are tough times we are living in right now, uncertain times. It means that the perspectives we have on the connections between past, present, and future are a bit skewed right now. Usually, when things feel somewhat more familiar and stable, as we look to the future, our comfortable practice is to try to set out our future course according to what we have done in the past. It's true in general, and it's true in the church. For example, if we've always worshiped on Sunday morning at 9:30 in the past, then that's what we'll do in the future. Why change it when what we do has worked fine before? We've always had our Sunday school classes according to age groupings in the past, then that's what we'll do in the future. In the past, we visited church members mostly only when they asked to be visited, always in person. Unless they were in healthcare or in the hospital, we visited them in those places. Then that's what we'll do in the future. In the past, we always had choirs, and the youth met in groups, and we had commissions, each in charge of different ministries. And we hosted outside groups like Weight Watchers in our building. And we had preschool classes for 3- and 4-year-old children so many mornings a week in the west end of the building. Then that's what we'll do in the future. And mind you, all of those things, all of those patterns have been good, have served us well. But for the most part, our commitment, our comfortableness with past patterns has meant that the future we've envisioned has typically been an extension of the past. And it's not that we never have new ideas or new plans or new projects. We do. A new building for the Manchester Early Learning Center, solar panels, Sing Me Home Festival. But those have been the exceptions. Most of our forward thinking has stood on the shoulders of our treasured and familiar patterns of the past, the familiar ways of doing things, seeking to do things of the past only slightly differently in the future. We don't court disruption or discomfort. Why would we? Instead, we've tried to build the future on the patterns on the past, on the prophets of old. And so over and over again, we have invoked the past as the standard for whether something might be valuable in the future. It says a lot about our sense of identity. And the scripture today invites us to think about identity. Who are we? Our history or our future? Our familiar patterns or our free-ranging imagination? I think Jesus asked the question, who do they say that I am, for a reason. He wants to know whether people are ready to see him as a repeat of the past or as a new possibility. Who do they say that I am? Some say this prophet or that prophet, certainly one of the big names of the past. Otherwise, how could you do miracles? How could you challenge authority? How could you heal and teach and lead? The prophets of the past did it, so you must be one of them. And that's often the way we think. We look over our shoulders for confirmation, for direction. But sometimes, maybe in times like these, the present moment changes so radically that it's not just a continuation of the past. It's something completely and uncomfortably and even irritatingly new. Look, no one likes change. No one wants change. No one chooses the upside-down version of what has been familiar and comfortable and even effective. But when the new day breaks upon us, looking backwards for inspiration, for authority, for direction, in the midst of already upside-down times, times like these, is the equivalent of seeing Jesus at work in ministry in the present moment and being pretty sure that he's actually Elijah or Jeremiah or some other big name of the past. Peter, somehow, probably only with the insight and grace of God, gets it right. Somehow he recognizes that the Jesus moment, the Jesus ministry, is not about recycling the past. It's about a promise of the future. It's about thinking, what do we want? What are we called to now and in the future? What have we really been waiting for? More of the same? Or who knows what? Emotionally speaking, I really don't like who knows what. Honestly, most days I'd like more of the same. Not the stale version of more of the same, but the fresh version. The version that still offers something familiar, something that doesn't keep challenging my assumptions, my experience, my clear understandings, my settled relationships. But right now, it feels like right now, we don't have that luxury. We have to keep swimming forward. We have to keep asking ourselves, now what? We have to keep using imagination and conviction and fearlessness. I know for some people that's frustrating, disorienting, even depressing. Why can't we go back to what we were doing? When will we go back to what we were doing? What about reaching back to the practices of old, the prophets of old? But there's no going back to the old. There will eventually be a time when the pandemic is over, but there will be no going back to the old. There will be a time when we will all be able to gather together safely in this space, but there will be no going back to everything exactly as it was. And along the way, some things will be forever lost. What will those things be? I don't know. But there will be some things that are forever lost. There will be practices and patterns and familiar things that we won't be able to do anymore, that we won't go back to, that we won't want to go back to. And there will be grief over that. And in some cases, anger about that. But the scripture story this morning pushes this truth that Jesus isn't a prophet of old, and Simon isn't Simon anymore. Jesus is the Messiah, and Simon is forever after Peter. Not that everything is easy going forward, but everything goes forward. New names, new identity, new purpose, new practices, new communities, new selves, new heaven, new earth. Look, there are some things about this time that I really, really don't like, some changes that I really, really don't like. I prefer face-to-face over Zoom. I do not like preaching into a camera. I'd rather see your faces, read your expressions, feel the unspoken conversation that happens when I am with you in person. And I feel handicapped, not only as a preacher, but as a pastor, by not being able to read the room, to look around, to look into your eyes and see your hearts. Whether it's in the sanctuary or in the narthex, in the Family Life Center, in the Sunday school rooms, at fellowship meal, in the kitchen. I don't like these new ways of trying to connect. I prefer the church of old, the way it was, way, way back before mid-March, which seems like it was years ago. And I also know that the online life of the church, this life that we are living in right now with an unknown end in sight, excludes or limits some, either because of access or skill with technology or preference, and for others, it is exhausting, maybe even unfulfilling. But I also know that there are people who are joining us from far away, people who have found us who didn't know we were here before, or who knew we were here but hadn't connected, people who need a congregation like ours, a congregation of compassion-offering, service-oriented, community-building, peace-committed, justice-yearning, action-taking, science-believing, faith-expressing, globally concerned, denominationally rooted, Jesus-following people like us. We don't even begin to know who all of you are, who is connecting with us, who is tenderly and maybe timidly stepping into this holy space with us. But we do know this. We aren't Simon of Jonah anymore. We have to be Peter. We have to be named with a name that isn't only the name of heritage, but the name of possibility. The new name, the expanded identity of hope, of challenge, of new imagination, of courage in the face of change, in the face of all this uncertainty and all this change. I'll be honest, this is hard, and it will continue to be hard, hard for all of us. I've been thinking a lot about how Amy has been finding her way into pastoral relationship with us, especially as we celebrate and consecrate that relationship a little bit later in the service today. I've been thinking about that as I remember how I entered into this congregation all those years ago and how hard it was even then when I could see many of your faces, observe your interactions with each other, take it all in and begin to let it take root in me. This is harder. She has to be so much more intentional, take so much more initiative, and wait so much longer for these opportunities. But she's doing it. And we are all doing it. And doing it in new and creative ways. Being who we are, but also being who we didn't imagine we would have to be just 6 months ago. Everything has changed, and we have to change too. And we are. The key question I'd invite you to ask isn't, when can we go back to the way things were? But instead, this question: how can we meet the deep needs that we have and that the world has in these times of uncertainty and limitation? How can we do it in new and creative ways? Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do they say that I am?" And the answers the disciples have heard and share with him point to the past. But when he says, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter's answer points to the present and the future. And then Jesus says to Peter, "And I know who you are." And again, it's an affirmation that this is not just about history, but about hope. If there's anything that this time has given us, it is this: the realization that we have to adapt. We have to have courage. We have to look forward. We have to find ways to change. And if we feel the urge to hold on, the thing we should be holding on to is hope. We can become the rock upon which Christ will build the church. Jesus is not the prophet of old, but the Messiah of the present. Simon has become Peter, and we too have to be new people for this new day. Solid in faith, but forward moving in hope. right now, in these times, we are laying a new foundation for the church. And Jesus is ready to give us the keys to the kingdom. Amen. Please join me for some moments of silent prayer and reflection.